Well, we've made it all the way to chapter 9, and I think we should have someone who speaks German read the title for us.
Das Höhlenvolk in des Herrenvolk.
What does that mean?
Das Höhlenvolk is when the whole entire nation thought that they were the lords.
Mm-hmm.
So they are the progressed people, and this term folk means they're the people of, they're his people.
Okay.
The Lord's people.
Right. And I think the choice of German is not coincidental, as you see throughout the chapter. There are several references to German history, to Hitler and to the Nazis, and we'll maybe discuss that briefly later on. But the basic question is, who are...
The Herren? Who is the Herren?
No, this whole...
This Herren folk?
This Herren folk, yes. So who are the people of God? And this chapter makes a very simple statement, like all of the other chapters, that is contrasted with another statement that people commonly believe. And the statement that's argued here is that the people of God in the Bible are the Jews, are Israel. It seems like a simple statement, and probably if you say that at first glance, not many people would disagree. But it's contrasted with another statement, which is that Christian theology makes Christians the people of God. So there is actually a bit of a conflict there. Who is the people of the God of the Bible? That's what we'll be discussing mostly today, but I want to first ask, as usual, if anyone has any questions or comments from last time, chapter 8, we talked about the usage of eudaioi in the Messianic writings, the Greek word which is usually translated Jews, but most of the time probably should not be translated that way because it refers to a subset of Jews, not to Jews generally. Yes?
Any idea why John used it so often, whereas other authors didn't?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a partial explanation in that chapter, talking about his audience, that he's often trying to explain things to people who wouldn't be familiar with the situation, and so a lot of his usages are just along those lines, saying, like, Pesach is a festival of the Eudaioi, and so forth. I don't have a complete answer to that, but I think if you look at... sort of stylistic commentaries on John, you'll find that a lot of people say that the language in which it's written is different from the other Gospels, not only in this respect, but in general. It's a more polished and more fluid type of Greek language. So, in general, the styles of these different books are not identical. And that should be kept in mind. Now, I can't really give you more information than that, but I think, again, if you do look in some reference works, you'll find that John is unique not only in this, but in a lot of other respects in his writing. Mm-hmm. Any other issues or questions? Maybe we should take one example, just to be clear on what we mean. Because actually, if you remember, I had asked you to come back with any challenges or problems that you had with this interpretation. We discussed sort of the advantages and the frustrations of this explanation. So maybe we'll just take one example. If you look at John 7, which is, I think, one that we mentioned last time, in the first verse, it says, after these things, Yeshua walked in Galilee. What kinds of people live in Galilee?
Galileans.
Galileans. Would you describe them as Jews or Gentiles?
Jews.
Jews, primarily. So he walked in Galilee, according to the King James Version, for he would not walk in Jewry, because the Jews sought to kill him. What is this verse saying, do you think? Yeah, it seems to be very clearly saying that the Yehudim, in other words, the people from Judah, were seeking to kill him, so he would not walk in Judea. That's what the Jewry is here.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he's talking about the Jewish religious leaders.
Okay.
Seeking to kill him, not the people of Judah.
Okay. That's maybe an even better explanation. Thank you. But I think the geographical aspect here is that most of those people would have been in Jerusalem, in Judea. So that's why he's leaving the area, in other words. But yeah, I agree with you. And I think that in most of these cases, it really is talking about the Jewish religious leaders. Then we had later on in that same chapter a verse. Does anyone have their Bible open to John 7? Can you read us maybe 11 through 13?
You got it there?
Yeah, I got it. At the festival, the Judeans... This is... starting. At the festival, the Judeans were looking for him. "Where is he?" they asked. And among the crowds, there was much whispering about him. Some said, "He's a good man," but others said, "No, he's deceiving the masses." However, no one spoke about him openly for fear of the Judeans.
Okay, so Judean here is Iudaioi. And probably, again, as Leslie was saying with the last verse, it should actually be the Judean religious, political, and religious authorities. But in each case, the word is Iudaioi, and in most English translations and in most other translations, it's simply given as Jews. So it misleads people into thinking that the Jews as a whole had a particular attitude or perspective towards Yeshua. I wanted to draw your attention maybe to a couple other passages, because I was looking at John 4 recently, which is the story of the Samaritan woman. And at the beginning of the chapter, it says, "The Pharisees heard that Yeshua was gaining and baptizing more disciples than Yohanan, although in fact it was not Yeshua who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee." So again, you seem to have this geographical dimension linked with the political religious authorities, the Pharisees in this case. So Yeshua, to avoid confrontation in this instance, leaves Judea and goes back to Galilee. And that's a similar situation to what was described in John 7, which we just read. And then at the end of John 4, Yeshua actually comes to Galilee. And it says, "After the 2 days he left for Galilee, now Yeshua himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him," or received him. "They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they had also been there." And I wanted to point this out because it seems like there's almost a non sequitur here. If you read it from the perspective of traditional interpretation, it says that Yeshua pointed out that he had no honor in his own country. Well, he was from Galilee. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. So what's the explanation here? Is there a contradiction in terms?
Maybe they welcomed him as a son of Galilee as opposed to the Messiah of Israel.
Well, it says that they had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem.
Then I don't know.
I think that there's a consistent presentation, in other words, in the Gospels, that the common people were accepting of Yeshua and responded positively towards him. But what he's talking about in many instances when people reject him is the machers, the big shots. Mm-hmm. You know, the leaders do not accept him. And so one has to take all of these statements in context. You know, sometimes he was received by people, sometimes he was rejected by people. Sometimes he was rejected by his own family. But at other times, large crowds followed him. So both sides, again, are important to get the complete picture. And obviously, the last couple chapters have tried to set up that interpretation of distinguishing between the political, religious authorities and the people as a whole. Okay. Anything else on chapter 8? Well, what about this radical statement that in the Bible the people of God are the Jews? What do you think?
It's not so radical. Preaching
to the choir. That's not what I thought about this. I was like, okay, I mean, this was great to tell other people. For me, this didn't change my mind. This is the way I believe.
Okay. But do we have any Gentiles here?
Yeah. Change my mind.
All right.
Open my eyes.
What does this mean for you?
I mean, as a believer, how would I fit?
As a Gentile. If the people of God are not believers, but the Jews, what does that mean?
Well, I have always said that we're not supposed to say that we're Jews and all that stuff, but didn't Ruth become a Jew when she became? I mean, I don't have any problem one way or the other, you know, I know my own God. But, you know, don't you become into the family? So aren't you adopted in?
Drafted in.
So I know, but so aren't we adopted in? I mean, if you adopt a child, you don't say, you know, your name is Smith and they're Brown. You don't say, oh, that's Bill Brown. You say, no, that's Bill Smith. Uh-huh. So aren't we, in a sense, I know we don't think because it's not good witnessing to Jews, but aren't we Jews too? Because in a sense, I mean, I don't need to be a Jew, but I'm just trying to say, it seems like if I go down, because I know some people think, you know, you want to be Jews, okay. It's okay. Better than to be Jews that, and Gentiles.
Right.
But it just seems like it's simple logic, that if you could become into your family, you're part of that, you're that family now.
Well, I mean, I married into Herta's family in a sense, and believe me, I could never become one of them. Nor could she become one in my family, although we are related.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think in that sense, you're right. You came up, you became part of the family. Mm-hmm. Okay. But that didn't make you a Jew. Mm-hmm. You didn't change and you didn't transfigure into it. Okay, now I am Jewish.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I mean, it looks like that. I answer that.
Right.
So how does that work, though? I mean,
she is part of the people of God now.
She is definitely part of the people of God.
She's part of God's family. Yeah. Right.
There's still a division between...
The wall of division between Jew and Gentile was removed by Yeshua.
Well, the blessings of Abrahamic covenant blessings. Those are not open to me, and I'm fine with that. I'm just trying to say that's my intent, right? Those would not be open to me. Those are the physical children, the physical descendants of Abraham, right?
Well,
that's at least one interpretation.
Yeah, that's one interpretation. Okay. I guess we'd have to look at specific passages to see if that's true or not. I don't know if that's always true, but... does anyone else want to respond to this? I mean, I think it's good because that's why we're here, to try to get at the truth of things. And I, by the way, just one quick comment. I don't think the correct answer is the one that's going to be most palatable to Jews or the one that's going to be most palatable to Gentiles. The correct answer is the one that's true according to what God says in His Word. So that's what we're going to try to discover. Yeah.
It's interesting because now I can... have a different perspective, but before, like a few years ago, if you tell me you are not people of God, I will really feel like you have insulted me, you know, like that I am not a people of God. How can you say that, you know? But after you learn a little bit about what the scriptures are saying to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, you realize, no, I have been crafted, you know, I mean, it's by His mercy that I am part of His family, you know, but it's nothing that I, how do you say, I don't know what to
call it. It's
I mean, it's nothing that again, it's by grace. It's by grace. It's nothing that we have been chosen to be. You know, it's just.
But won't that mean you have to first determine what a Jew is? Is it someone who is of the descendant line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Yeah. Is it someone who was born in Judea? Is it someone who was born in Israel? Is it someone whose family has some Jewish blood? But you know, how much Jewish blood then constitutes that you're Jewish? Do you have to have 51% or, you know, if you have 2%, does that count? And once you figure out who is a Jew, you also have to remember something very important. God said Jew and Gentile together from the Tanakh, from the prophets, from everywhere, and clearly into the New Covenant scriptures, Jew and Gentile together. So if you all became Jews when you became believers, then we wouldn't have Jew and Gentile together. We'd have a party of Jews. So I think we're going to determine what is a Jew or who is a Jew and what it means to be grafted in.
And also maybe what difference does it make?
Exactly.
If Jews and Gentiles end up together anyways, does it make any difference what we're discussing?
Don't we get the better condos in heaven?
I think that was in one of the apocryphal books, actually. In reference to Ileana's comment, I just wanted to refer to how Yeshua acted with regard to Gentiles, by the way. And this is something that is often overlooked or people try to explain it away. But Yeshua said he was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Did that mean that he had no interaction with Gentiles?
No.
No.
When did he have interaction with Gentiles?
When they came to him.
Okay.
Samaritan village.
Okay.
The woman who asked to have the crumbs from the master's table.
Okay, let's just take those two examples. How does Yeshua treat these Gentile women?
The Samaritan woman is not Gentile necessarily.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's she's not considered Jewish in that day, exactly, but it's sort of the Samaritans are sort of hybrid. Yeah, maybe Gentile isn't exactly the right word. So how does Yeshua treat the Samaritan woman? And how does he treat the other Gentile woman? I forget at the moment where she was from, but I think it's mentioned in the passage if anyone wants to look it up. And this might actually be an even more striking illustration if we consider the Samaritan woman first and then the other one.
You question them about their lives.
Okay. All right. And then is he sort of respectful of her traditions and tolerant towards her and her differentness?
Not exactly.
Not really. What does he say?
He can go.
You worship on this mountain. Salvation is of the Jews. Yeah, salvation is of the Jews.
And actually, she's being pretty nice to him, right? And she's asking questions and being respectful, and she's saying, you know, I've heard such and such about how we're supposed to worship God. She says, I see you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. He says, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is of the Jews. Mm-hmm. So he makes a pretty strong...
Harsh.
Yeah, it sounds pretty harsh. It's a pretty strong distinction. And it's sort of saying, you know, we're the people of God, and we know what we're doing, and you don't. That's kind of what it sounds like.
Try to soften it a little bit by saying, eventually it doesn't really matter... It's what's important is to worship him in your heart.
Okay. All right.
Truth.
Yep. But his response is clearly the kind of thing that might seem intolerant from a modern perspective. And then what about the other woman?
She came back.
She was asking for his daughter's healing. Yeah. And he said something like, I've been sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And she said something about even the dogs get the crumbs from the table.
Right.
It's not good to take the bread from the children and cast it to dogs.
Yeah, and then she said that.
And then he said, oh, woman, great is your faith.
Yes. Right. Yeah. So it says the woman was a Greek born in Syria and Phoenicia. She begged Yeshua to drive the demon out of her daughter. First, let the children eat all they want, he told her, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. It's a pretty striking statement.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's pretty clear what he means, too. I mean, it's just told us that she's non-Jewish.
An analogy to dogs.
Right, he makes an analogy to dogs. It's pretty insulting, I would say.
Especially in the Middle East, that's even more insulting.
Uh-huh. So he's... apparently, I say apparently because I think there's something deeper going on, but he's apparently not treating her with respect due to this Jewish-Gentile difference. And one of the issues that's raised in this book is a common objection among Gentiles, both within and without the Messianic movement, of the idea that they might feel second class if certain ideas are promoted. Well, Yeshua seems to be the champion of promoting these types of ideas here, of making people feel second class. If comparing children to dogs doesn't do that, then I don't really know what does. So he certainly seems to be trying to make her feel second class. I don't think that's actually what he's doing. But what is her response? And that's a key part of the story, of course. "Yes, Lord," she replied, "but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he healed her daughter because of her response. Now, in my understanding, I mean, you want to look at these places and other related places later on. In my understanding, what Yeshua is doing is he's looking for humility. And if you look at these cases, many of them, in which he does something for Gentiles, in which they seem to be second class at first, he actually uses it as an example to Israel. After they've accepted a humble position and come in complete humility, he turns around to his own people and he says, "Not even in Israel have I found faith like this."
Yeah.
You know? So what's going on is deeper than just what might appear on the surface. And I think that's an important perspective to keep in mind throughout all of the discussion. What is God looking for from Jews? He's looking for a humble attitude and acceptance of what he says and willingness to fulfill it. What is God looking for from Gentiles? He's looking for a humble attitude and acceptance of what he says and willingness to fulfill it. So it's not like this is so unequal or strange in that sense. It's not what most people in our modern world would consider equal or identical treatment, that's for sure. We'll look at that a little bit more, and it's partly explained in Romans 2. But the principle is absolutely identical. And so, again, the way in which certain things are stated in the Bible, if you just take them at surface value, they may in fact seem to imply that you or I are second class in some sense. But actually, usually they're a wake-up call, God's way of getting our attention to communicate something to us. And it doesn't only apply to Jews and Gentiles, by the way. What about when God talks about righteous people and wicked people? And then he says that I'm a sinner. Well, that makes me feel second class. I don't like that. But the fact is, I am a sinner, and I need to know that, and I need to accept what God says about me and respond appropriately. So I think what Yeshua was saying here is part of the same system, if you will, of the way that God operates here. But let's maybe backtrack and look at the chapter in order in terms of the ideas that it presents. What are the arguments for saying that the people of God in the Bible are the Jews, or Israel? Yes.
I think it'd start with Abraham. He said, "I will make you a great nation."
Okay.
If you go to the land that I tell you, and God, and Abraham obeyed and went to that land, the land of Canaan. So
mm-hmm.
God was had to keep his part of the bargain and make him a great nation,
mm-hmm.
and that was the beginning.
Okay, and then all throughout Tanakh, of course, God calls Israel his people, and there, I think this chapter said there are 1.5 exceptions, right, to that, but basically there are dozens of times when Israel is termed the people of God, and the 1.5 exceptions are Isaiah 19:25, the Lord speaks of a future day in which Egypt and Assyria will turn to him. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, "Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance." This isn't usually what people mean when they have said throughout history that Israel is not the people of God, by the way. They don't usually refer to Egypt and Assyria. But that's an exception, talking about a great fulfillment of the restoration of the world that should come in the future. And then half of an exception in Zechariah, when many nations will be joined to the Lord and become to him a people.
What verse was that?
Which one? Zechariah 2:14 through 16 in Hebrew, or 10 through 12 in English. So basically all throughout Tanakh, Israel is termed the people of God, and not only that, that's only part of it. God calls himself the God of Israel, and that's how he identifies himself more than anything else. That's how he wants to be known. And the stories in Tanakh are very interesting in that often they're set up almost like a contest among different gods. And Pharaoh of Egypt has his gods, you know, and he says he's never heard of the God of the Hebrews and he's not going to let his people go. And God says, well, I am the God of the Hebrews and you are going to let my people go, basically. You know, and all throughout the Judges and the books of the Kings, you read about the different gods of the peoples and how they believe their God is giving them victory in war. Mm-hmm. And how does God identify himself? Well, he identifies himself like those gods with a particular people. And he says, this is my people. It's a people that he created in order to bear his name so that he could identify himself this way. So Israel is a way for God to make himself known in the earth. And one of the main points of this chapter is that it really doesn't have anything to do with Israel's behavior or Israel's choice. It has to do with God's choice. Man's choice cannot override God's choice. And this is maybe the whole point of the scriptures, that God has said, I will be faithful, and it doesn't matter if Israel is unfaithful. It doesn't matter whether how many times we turn away from him. God is still going to be faithful. And he repeats this over and over. And that's why the book of Hosea, such an extraordinary book, when you think about what it actually entails, is one of the not only most dramatic, but best pictures of what God's love for Israel is really like. And that's what Hosea is clearly about. And God makes that explicit. The prophet Hosea is told to go and marry a prostitute who he knows will be unfaithful to him, and she will keep going and being unfaithful to him, and he must keep loving her. And that's God's picture of his love for Israel, that though we are unfaithful, he will be faithful. So any theology or interpretation of the Bible that says that God in any way has decided to create a new people or move on is denying what God has said about his faithfulness to Israel. And if God is not true to his faithfulness to Israel, then there's no reason to expect him to be faithful to any other people. So that's a major part of the argument in this chapter. In addition, the claim is made, and this gets to some of Kyra's questions, that there's no new Israel in the scriptures. There's no spiritual Israel in the scriptures. There's no new people of God. There's only the same old Israel that's being talked about throughout. What do we think of this claim? A lot of people, by the way, say that Israel, when it appears later in the scriptures, means a new Israel or a spiritual Israel or something different.
Isn't there some spiritual Israel reference in Romans? Or?
Well, in Romans 2, it talks about internal and external things. That
who is really a Jew.
Right. Mm-hmm. Being a Jew truly has to do with circumcision of the heart, not only circumcision of the flesh.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that I think came up before, and unless I'm mistaken, I'm almost certain that it's a scripture that is dealt with in some detail in the book in a later chapter that we're going to consider. I don't think it's implying a separate spiritual Israel in any way. But it's saying that if you're a Jew, I mean, if you read the chapter in context, we can look at it if you want. You can open it up to Romans 2, because actually we'll probably be in Romans 1 and 2 quite a bit today. But if you open it up to Romans 2, keeping in mind what it says in Romans 1, you'll see what the point is. Or maybe that is Romans 1. Boy, we better open it up. But basically, God is saying in that passage, if you are a Jew and trust in the law or trust in yourself that you're righteous, you're mistaken, because God has always been looking for faithfulness of the heart. And so if you are a Jew and you have the law, you'll be judged under the law. And if you are a Gentile and don't have the law, you'll be judged without the law, because no one is without excuse, because God has made the truth known within people. So let's take a look. D- Does anyone have the passage?
Yeah, end of chapter 2.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly it was
early as
17, but
definitely from 25 on. Yeah. Do you want to read it, or?
I'm not sure if this is a passage I was thinking of. Maybe it was in Galatians. I remember a phrase along the lines of, he's not of Israel, who is something only, but he is of Israel who has faith in God somehow.
I think that's the place where it says he's not a Jew who is one outwardly, but inwardly.
Which is here.
Yeah. Right, which is 229. And again, I mean, if you look at it in context, it's talking about external obligations as opposed to the internal heart.
Testament. Said, well, what did they call the people who were becoming? They called them disciples. They didn't call them people of God. They might have called them the sons of God. I don't know that they called them the people of God or any reference other than, I mean, if you're a son, then you're part of the family of God.
Right.
So I'm sure there's some other verses in the New Testament.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, let's not spend too much time on this particular passage, just because, again, I think it is dealt with later, and it is not talking about a new Israel or spiritual Israel. It's talking about what God expects from individual people, whether Jews or Gentiles. And that's the context of Romans 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back to some of the other passages in Romans 1 and 2. But also, just to quickly disprove the idea that what Paul might be saying here is that anyone who comes to God is a Jew, is truly a Jew. Anyone who has a circumcised heart is a Jew. Then look at what he says immediately following that, keeping in mind, of course, that chapter divisions are not in the original text. He says, what advantage then is there in being a Jew, or what value is there in circumcision? Much in every way. And then he goes on to talk about things that God has given to Jews specifically, not to Gentiles. So, again, if you look at the passage in context, it's describing what God's expectations have always been, as described in Jeremiah and Ezekiel and other places, for Jews and Gentiles. Again, at the end of chapter 1, it says, that it's speaking about different kinds of people. It says that they have no excuse. They have no excuse because they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death. They not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. So this is explained in chapter 2 as being for both Jew and Gentile. There will be trouble and distress for every human being who does evil, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. Glory, honor, and peace for everyone who does good, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. So, in other words, the whole discussion assumes the existence of different categories of people, Jews and Gentiles. It can't be taken as breaking that down. Okay. Is that clear? Are people satisfied with that for the moment? Well, we've just started chapter 9, but we're in Romans 2. Yeah. Okay, so let me go back to the original question. What do you think of this idea that when the scriptures talk about Jews or Israel, wherever it appears that it's actually talking about the same old Jews and the same old Israel.
I'm thinking about, it might be a tangent, but when I visit Gentile congregations, when they play the song, they want to identify with the Jewish people, they found out that a Jewish guy is going to be speaking there. They'll play Awake, O Israel.
Uh-huh.
And they're really thinking that they're singing to themselves, about themselves.
Right.
And you're all familiar with that song.
Yeah.
Awake, O Israel, put off your slumber. I mean, that one, or what's the other one? There are other Israel songs. Can't think of what they all are. But then a royal priesthood, a chosen generation, scriptures that were particularly referencing, as I thought, to the Jewish people.
Right.
And as a Jewish believer, I'm identifying those scriptures and personalizing them, and I'm often wondering, are they trying to massage the scriptures in such a way that it would be all-encompassing?
Well, I think most people wouldn't even ask that question because it's just so accepted.
Right.
It's accepted that, you know, God says through the prophet Isaiah, no weapon formed against you will prosper, that every believer can claim that and so forth. If you look at it in context, it is talking about, you know, specific people, as are most of the promises that God gives.
I'm always wondering what's left for Gentiles.
Exactly. Now that's the problem that people run into.
Yeah.
That's exactly the problem. They say, well, if this interpretation that you're proposing is right, in other words, that the text means what it says, that when it talks about God promising certain things to Israel, that it actually means that God is promising certain things to Israel, well, what's left for the Gentiles? And I think a large part of the answer is that it is the same thing that Yeshua said to the Samaritan woman. Salvation is of the Jews. You know, you have to associate with the Jewish people to receive these blessings. In other words, it's not something new that can be created. It's not a new religion, a new people of God, a new way of life that can be created and can appropriate these things. Now, of course, not all Christians think that way, but by and large, Christianity has thought that way. It thinks of itself as a self-sufficient religion, a self-sufficient organism that has all of the blessings from God and has a direct relationship with God, whereas actually, in the Bible, God presents Gentiles as having, in a sense, an indirect relationship with him. They come to the God of Israel through Israel. And this is, to a large extent, what Romans is about. It's written to Gentile believers, largely, who are saying, if you can believe Romans 11, that or are thinking that they can exist apart from the Jews. And Paul is writing to them to correct this idea, to say that you can't, to say that God has provided a particular way. Now, we'll probably look at that a little bit later on as well. Any other thoughts on the questions that have been raised so far before we move on in the chapter? Yes.
I think the way I've been understanding it for a while is that historically the people of God in the Bible are the Jews in terms of the time period that this was written. And my understanding of the time period after this was written is that Gentile believers get included along with Jewish believers as the people of God, something along those lines.
Okay. It's hard to talk about something after the scriptures were written, though. I think we would all agree that Gentiles who join themselves to God become part of his people. And that's one of the exceptions that's described. But the way in which Gentiles become part of God's people is very different, depending on which interpretation you adapt. Whether you say that the people of God are the Jews and Gentiles can join themselves to that people of God, or whether you say that there's a new people of God, which includes everybody, they are two very different things, and they result in two very different lifestyles and approaches. And it may sound technical, but actually, as is shown in this chapter, it leads to things like the Holocaust. It's not a technical difference. It's a pretty important difference. And a major reason that this happened is, again, because of little translation issues. And that was described in the chapter with regard to the section on Goyim, where this word is translated in various ways, sometimes as Gentiles, which is probably the best of the typical translations, sometimes as heathen, and sometimes as pagans. What does the word actually imply, Goyim?
Nations.
And so, as we've discussed a few times, Israel is itself referred to as a nation, a goy, on occasion in the scriptures. Actually, just recently I came across a very interesting article, a scholarly article that was entitled, "When is the Chosen People Called a Goy?" And it was actually written in 1964. It's a brief article, very interesting. It was by a guy, Aelred Cody, who was living in Jerusalem, which at that time was given as Jerusalem, Jordan. And his basic argument is that Goy is linked inseparably with territory and government and what we would today call foreign relations. So in a few instances where Israel is described in that sort of sense, it is mentioned as a Goy. But usually it's described as Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, which, according to this author, most expressed those things which belong to the heart of Israel and to Israel's relationships with God. So he sees some difference in the usage of the two words, Am and Goy, although he says that they overlapped at the time. But basically, the word did have a definite meaning. And it was a meaning that could sometimes be applied to Israel when Israel was viewed sort of as a nation, and it was most often used for other nations when they were viewed as distinct peoples with distinct territories, distinct states often, among other nations. So that's how it should be translated, and in fact, that's how it was translated in the Septuagint, or close to that, as ethnos, goy becoming ethnos, or people group, goyim becoming ethnoi. And the corresponding Latin for ethnos would be, I think, gentilis. I do have it somewhere here. Is that what it is? Yeah. Yeah, which gives rise to the term Gentiles. Okay. So, in other words, both the Greek and the Latin words implied someone who is from a particular people group, a particular clan, or tribe of peoples, and that's the origin of the word Gentiles, when they're viewed separate from people. But basically, Goyim refers to nations. So why is it translated as heathens and pagans?
Because then they take on the Gentile believers and become the people it's talking about instead of Jews.
Okay, but I mean, even in Tanakh, for example, when Goyim appears, sometimes it's translated as heathens or pagans.
Because of the practices of the nations, what they were doing at that time.
Okay, yeah, so an interpretive step is taken, which isn't in the text. The text is just talking about nations, and it may be talking about detestable practices of the nations. And so instead of translating it as nations, they translate it as pagans and heathen. But keep in mind that the text also talks about detestable practices of Israelites.
But you wouldn't stop
calling them Israelites just because it's talking about their detestable practices, right?
That substantiates the text of 1964.
Yes.
It became as Goyim.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually a very important distinction. Why is it so important? Well, because then it forces people to be misled by the text when they're reading these passages. For example, we had the scripture that was talking about how people should conduct themselves among the Gentiles. And the argument was made in this chapter, I think it was from 1 Peter, that if you're talking to Jews, which the letter appears to be appears to be addressed to Jews, then it makes sense to talk to them about their behavior among the Gentiles. If you're writing to Gentiles, it doesn't make a lot of sense to tell them to be careful about their behavior among Gentiles. So taking the letter out of context, people would interpret the Gentiles to be pagans or heathens and say, well, this is talking about believers among pagans or heathens. But there's a big problem with this, because it means that Gentiles who read these passages will not have a proper sense of their Gentile identity. They won't understand who they are. If it's as if we were talking about males and females, and we were writing something that dealt with pugnacious males, you know, males who are always looking for a fight. And then these males, and we translated it that way. So we talked about, instead of talking about male and female, we talked about female and pugnacious people. Female people and pugnacious people. Okay? Then what happens to these men when they stop being pugnacious?
They become female.
They become female, exactly. And, well, that's a different issue. But that's exactly what's happening here in the translation of Jew and Gentile. You instead of maintaining the distinction that God presents between the Jewish nation and the nations, it's translated as Israel and the pagans or the heathens, which is a different distinction. Keep in mind again that at times Israel fell away into idolatry and was observing pagan and heathen practices. So what happens here is that someone who is in the category of a heathen, when they stop being a heathen, they think that they are now Jewish, just as these men who were placed in the category of being pugnacious think that they are now women. That's not what God is saying. Or just to use the male-female analogy again, if, Proverbs talks about the nagging wife. Well, if a letter was addressed to women who were nagging, and instead of describing them, whenever it said women or wife, it translated it as naggers, then when these women stop being naggers, they wouldn't know that they were still women, because that's not the way it's described in the text. So, in other words, if God truly has made a distinction between Israel and the nations, if God truly has made a distinction between Israel and the nations, that's an important distinction for us to know about. As Bobby was saying, if that distinction doesn't exist, then you can't have the two of them together. You can't have Jews and Gentiles together if Jews and Gentiles are not two separate things. So the distinction should be maintained in the translations, just as the distinction between male and female should be maintained in translations. And when we read in Proverbs about a nagging wife should not be translated as nagging, you know. Nagging should be translated as nagging. And if we read in Tanakh about detestable practices of Goyim should not be translated as detestable people or pagans or heathen. The detestable practices should be translated as detestable practices. So it's very important for both Jews and Gentiles to have this sense of identity, that God has created them in certain ways for certain purposes. And I think we can see that more clearly perhaps if we do go back to Romans 2, which I think is one of the most striking passages with regard to these Jewish and Gentile issues. Something that is not, I think, hard to understand, but hard to accept. And maybe we can start with verse 9, if someone wants to start reading in verse 9, keeping in mind that in the previous chapter, Paul has just said he's not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God to salvation to all who believe, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So would someone like to read from Romans 2:9 on? Maybe the first person could read verses 9 through 11.
Go ahead, Barry.
Yes, he will pay back misery and anguish to every human being who does evil, to the Jew first, then to the Gentile, but glory and honor and peace to everyone who keeps doing what is good, to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. For God does not show favoritism.
So this is what I mean when I say that it's not hard to understand, but it's hard to accept. Because what verses 9 and 10 say is that God does not treat Jews and Gentiles identically. And then what verse 11 says is that the reason he doesn't treat them identically is because he doesn't show favoritism.
It seems contradictory.
Yes.
Seems contradictory in our framework. But what is the principle that God operates on? From him to whom much is given, much is required. So, in other words, he treats people as who they are. He doesn't pretend that people are the same. Because he didn't create people to be exactly the same. He created different kinds of people on both an individual level and a national level, if you will. So this is a very strange statement for us in our modern mindset. Now, keep in mind, of course, that this is the same God who said there shall be one law for you and for the foreigner in your midst. So he's not advocating being unfair. He's saying that he has a particular order and way of doing things.
Does this refer only to the natural?
What do you mean?
Well, when we get into the spirit realm, it says we are neither male nor female nor Jew nor Greek, but one in the spirit of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if the spirit realm is exactly the way to describe that. I mean,
okay.
I don't think the Bible has this